As varied as our topography and soils, as rich as our resources, so varied and rich are the voices and stories of the folks around us. Come neighbor a bit with me, Sam Stroop. Grab a cup of coffee, pull up a comfy chair, let's get to talking. Andy McMurray makes a living for his family raising wool sheep. That's a rare thing anymore. Most everyone in the United States raises hair sheep so that they don't have to shear the wool off the sheep every year. I've watched Andy raise his sheep and family for going on 30 years now. When we were still milking cows, Kathleen and I tried sheep, hoping it would work for us, as I could see the end coming for small dairies. But we just couldn't figure out fencing and predator problems, and so we sold our 200 ewes. Andy stayed on top of it and has done well. I'm anxious to quiz him on his operation. So Andy and I are sitting here on a front porch in the shade, and I'm really anxious to find out things I don't know. And, you kind of hit and miss with questions over the years, but when you figure, I'm going to focus on the things I don't know and find out for sure what's going on in his world of raising sheep. Going way back, I remember hearing from my sister Penny about this wild and crazy guy who went to New Zealand. And what did you go there for? Was it to find out about sheep, or you'd want to find out about New Zealand?
It was primarily about the sheep. At that time, there was a lot of noise in our industry for the sheep, particularly to do with wool, because wool imports from the Southern Hemisphere were overtaking our market. So there was a lot of tension over that. And I kind of had an investigative reporter kind of curiosity and wanted to know. And it was lamb as well, what was really going on. So that piqued my curiosity. I wanted to travel anyway, and the exchange program was available.
How old were you?
That was just out of high school, so I was 19. Mm-hmm. And several local groups sponsored me.
Wow.
Which was really cool. I was really forced out of my comfort zone to go around soliciting myself in that way, but they were very warm and helpful. And the deal was I'd give them a slideshow when I came back, which I liked photography anyway, so I had lots of photos when I came back.
How long were you actually in New Zealand?
I was there for 9 months.
Wow.
So three of those months, well, actually turned out to be less than three. It was supposed to be 3 months on a dairy farm, which turned out to be more like 2 months. And then the remainder of it was on a sheep farm. Mm-hmm.
And did you travel around the island and see multiple sheep operations?
Or
if you see one, you see them all?
No, it's very diverse. And I did travel. I got to travel quite a bit. And it was, there was a few segments of the industry that I didn't get to see that I wish I would have. But I got to see a lot. It was...
Backtracking just a hair, you said that the wool market, the U.S., was the Southern Hemisphere was getting to be a threat. Mexico, where are the sheep in south of the border?
I don't know too much. I know the Mexican government subsidizes the sheep industry,
okay,
and they take it pretty seriously.
I see.
And pretty sophisticated in some instances, not in all instances. But that's the limit of my knowledge about
I bet Bolivia.
Mexico. I know the South America is huge.
Mm-hmm.
But primarily by Southern Hemisphere, I meant New Zealand and Australia.
Oh, okay. Gotcha.
Yeah.
Gotcha.
They're the dominant.
Yeah. So. Now I can see the Indians in Bolivia and Paraguay out there in the scrub pushing some sheep around. That's why I backed you up a minute.
Yeah. So in some cases, they're quite sophisticated, mm-hmm, probably more so than us.
Did you come away from New Zealand saying, that's amazing, but I'm not sure that's going to work in Missouri?
I had some idealistic, ideas that things that worked there would work here that turned out to not. But
talk about those a little
bit. Well, some of the forages aren't suited to our climate. Some of the sheep genetics aren't suited to our climate. Some of the management details don't relate because it gets too cold in the winter, too hot in the summer. But the core management, the holistic, you know, forage-based production, growing as much of your own feed as you can. A lot of those bigger, you know, economic factors that make a farm work do very much work and do need to be implemented. And I have exploited those. So it's a weeding out of what would and wouldn't work.
So you borrowed a lot of what you learned here.
Yeah.
Now, this maybe you can't answer. Do you think the sheep industry in New Zealand has changed much? That was 30 years ago.
Yeah, it's crazy. It has changed. They have a much smaller ewe flock, but they produce more pounds of lamb with far fewer ewes. So they've really increased prolificacy and growth rates.
Okay. Breeding within the breeds they had?
Some of both. They brought in some...
Polypay type
East Frisian, it's a dairy breed, was one that they used as a composite to get milk and birth rates up, and some other breeds from the primarily from the UK.
Mm-hmm. Interesting.
They create a composite. And that was a cool part. The country's so diverse. It's small, size of Colorado, but you've got almost every climate type we have here in that small area. And every little area has a different type of sheep for that climate. So that was pretty neat to see.
Including hot and humid?
Well, not... That would be the exception.
Okay.
They probably don't have that. Well, at the tip of the North Island, it's tropical. So they would have that there.
But they don't have sheep there necessarily.
Not as many,
yeah.
But some. But yeah, that place looks, it's crazy. It looks like, you know, Cuba or something. The types of trees and stuff is pretty cool.
Is there only predators, the Chinese?
They have...
By that meaning, they eat their sheep.
They have a bird. Is it a magpie? If a sheep gets cast, it'll pluck its eyes out.
If a sheep gets what?
So a lot of times if sheep are heavy pregnant and have a long fleece, they get over on their backs and can't correct themselves.
Okay.
So they're laying there on their back. These birds will come pluck their eyes out.
Okay.
But other than that, they don't have a lot of predators in New Zealand. In Australia, they do.
Yeah. Chris Rolfing, I saw the other night, or a week ago at the art festival. And they had been to New Zealand a year ago in November. And I said, so, what'd you think? He said, wow, it was like going back to the United States and seeing agriculture here in the 60s, meaning profitability, medium-sized farms.
Yeah.
And I wonder why it has stayed profitable and not huge conglomerations like we're getting here in the United States.
It's a really good question. That's the next... That would be the next investigative journalistic study to do. It's a very interesting question. The dairy farm on the North Island was where I was at initially, and that was a real eye-opener. They're in a high rainfall. It was a very high land value area. And they'd put 250 cows in a 5-acre pasture for 12 hours. And if it happened to rain that night, I mean, the whole thing would be a mud hole the next morning.
Mm-hmm.
And, I mean, that was an extreme case. But it did happen, you know, once every couple weeks.
Yeah.
And they're making money. And those pastures would just recover so fast. It was just... phenomenal. But the philosophy is just so different.
Mm-hmm.
It was really important that their cows calve in a really narrow window of time because they're strictly seasonal milking. They have to milk when the grass is at its peak. Then they dry off their cows and go on holiday before it all starts again the next year. But highly profitable dairying. You know, 250 cows was just sort of a standard family. And there was multiple. There was one farm I visited. It was three brothers. They milked 1,000 cows in a single milking parlor. It didn't even have a roof. They developed their own stanchion system, which was just a bar. They just shoved them in. I think it was 50 to a side. And when they were done, the bar dropped in front of them. They just all stepped off.
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah, I visited the New Zealand dairies down in Springfield.
Yeah.
It is an awesome system. I kind of wonder if it's a little bit of this. The New Zealanders have always thought in terms of efficiency and what's going to make us money. Whereas it seems like our universities here, this is bad to say, it's what new chemical can we throw at the farmers and get them to buy it? You know,
it's wild stuff. It was a different culture, and they're Scots-Irish by mm-hmm. and large, which is what I am. And I grew up a tradesman, and just really, I mean, I almost felt more at home there than I do here. It's just the way we think. And
they share ideas, they share problems, they figure things out together.
A big part of it was they were an island country and they knew it. So they felt isolated from mm-hmm. the modern world, and they wanted to go to Disneyland and, you know, see all the American sights if they could at some point in their lives. So to them, their neighbor farmer was a means to success, mm-hmm. you know, not in a take advantage of way, but in a let's sort this out. So their cooperatives for marketing their dairy, those things were a lot more functional than what we have here. They work together. Lots of contractors for hay work, for example. If you have 250 cows, you don't have time to mow and rake and bale hay, so you just hire a contractor, and he does, you know, he has 10 such dairy farmers, and that's all he does. So it's a lot more, that part was pretty efficient.
They're on the edge of half the world's population for a market.
Yeah.
And they've learned how to really get into that. I was recently amazed to read that the Chinese, you know, they had that big brouhaha over the milk and then putting all these weird additives into it.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden, all the Chinese said, no, we ain't buying any of this crap. We want Jersey milk from New Zealand for our children. And there was New Zealand with their Jersey milk and a ready market to please the Chinese who wanted a different way of feeding their kids.
Well, and the big one when I was there was frozen butter to Russia.
Mm.
I mean, barge loads of it.
Wow.
So everything was opposite. They wanted small cows with high butter fat, high protein, low volume. Here we wanted big cows, high volume, low butter fat, and low protein. They wanted to spend as little as they could get away with on feed, whereas here you spend as much as you possibly can on feed. You push the cow for absolute maximum per cow. They didn't care about per cow production. They cared about per acre milk or per acre fat, butter fat. So, and it was like that at every segment of the industry. It was just everything was opposite. It just blew my mind.
Our wool became worth less and less and less because the quality here was so awful. And they kept perfecting a higher quality wool, which is what you got into over there, isn't it?
Right. That was more my interest. But the dairy was probably a better training capsule for the differences, if that makes sense. Lots and lots of electric fence, which that part I continue to be highly dependent on. Mm-hmm. You know, you got to control the animals. So the only way to do that quickly and cheaply is with electric fence.
So how did you get started in sheep over here then?
Well, my host father on the sheep farm was friends with CEO of a company that right when I was finishing up my stay was coordinating the first ever boatload of breeding sheep to be imported into the United States. Hmm. So this was thousands of sheep on a boat. So the cost per sheep was much lower. Normally when they wanted to import sheep, they'd put them on an airplane and it was, you know, thousands of dollars per sheep. So because of that connection, I was able to import like 5 or 6 sheep. And I built my whole flock off of those.
Wow.
And it was, you know, I was really naive. I was 19. I didn't know anything about how ag here really, really worked. Of course, if I had known what I know now, I would have never done it. But that's just life. and I don't have regrets. I just, you know, the magnitude of it was so much more than I could have imagined. But that's life too, you know. Mm-hmm. You have kids, it's like, that'll be a cute little baby to hold. And next thing you know, they're crashing the car. And you know, so that's just life.
What breed of sheep were they? What were they called that you brought over here?
So mine were primarily, I had a Romney and Merino.
Okay.
Very different wool types, but the specific ones I selected had really high quality wool for each of their types. And then I ended up crossbreeding those to get numbers up, trying to keep the core traits that the breeders had bred into them when I bought them. And then I've had to bring in new genetics with frozen semen since then many times, but I try to keep that core set of traits going.
Initially, was that quality of wool that you're producing respected?
The Romney's not so much, because it was a much coarser wool.
Okay.
It was more like mohair. So it's a different market, a different way you would use it. It was still beautiful stuff. It was just different. So typically here, it's always been how fine, how low the micron count is. My Merinos that I brought had that. But the Romneys were also extremely prolific. They milked really well. They were great forage converters, hardy, just real workhorse type sheep. So by combining those two traits, you know, you come up with a composite that fit well here. Mm-hmm. Over time, I found that. So
prolific and still a decently high quality wool.
Right.
Yeah. Huh. What did your numbers look like? You started out with 5 or 6. You brought over a ram also.
So the importation process was supposed to take 3 months and ended up being close to a year, I think.
Wow.
And they were all in a pen together for most of it. There was a Merino ram, so they came pregnant. Actually, they lambed during their trip.
And they were bred to just some funky U.S. ram?
No, they were bred to that Merino ram that
came
with them. Yeah.
Gotcha. But you didn't get that Merino ram. You just got his offspring.
No, I got him too.
Okay.
Yeah.
Gotcha.
So I, you know, the flock. Mm-hmm. And that's sort of the coolest part about all of this, is how much of the best stuff. I have a quote, all the best things in life, you had nothing to do with.
Huh.
You know, you couldn't say whether you were going to be born or not, but you were. You know, you couldn't have control over whether you had kids or not, but you did.
Yeah.
All the best things in life, just boom, there they are. So, yeah, so they did it on their own. And ever since then, I would have rams get out.
Mm-hmm.
And have a bunch of breedings I didn't plan.
Yeah.
And for some reason, you know, there was a really important sheep born in that disaster that went on to shape the whole flock. And I don't know, it's weird. It's almost like, you know.
What year was that you imported them?
So we started in 80, started the process in New Zealand in 88. I ended up driving to Oregon in October, I guess, of 89.
So you've been at it 31 years.
Yeah, to pick them up. And we went through a blizzard and it was a big deal. Because they came in through Canada, and Professor Don Wilkinson in Oregon, who was animal science professor at Washington State or maybe Oregon State University, he got the bulk of the shipload of sheep.
Okay.
And he agreed to bring them from Canada to his place, just along with his, and I could just pick them up at his place.
Mm-hmm.
So he was a key person in making it happen.
Mm-hmm. Your family was still dairying at that time here.
Yep, they were.
But they gave you a chunk of a corner to put your sheep on. Maybe you ran them with the cows, I don't know.
Yeah, it was so few that at the time anyway, it wasn't a stress to have them.
Early on, can you remember some big mistakes you made and had to overcome? Or we tend to try to forget those things, don't we?
Probably the biggest thing, for 20 years, I didn't have any predator problems. I have no idea why.
Mm.
And I started, you know, I got complacent, took that for granted, and then suddenly got into predator problems that took 10 or 15 years to stop.
Coyotes?
Stray dogs started it, and then that gets the coyotes started. it's really confusing because stray dogs will wound them or kill them. Coyotes will eat them. So you're out there looking at signs, and it's hard to know what's really going on. I wish that I had had guard dogs before it started, and then it would have never started. I'm convinced.
Yeah. But you didn't need them.
I've moved sheep out of this area with strong guard dogs into areas where there are no sheep. Coyotes are everywhere. And zero predation. So the dogs are almost 100% effective if they're established in a territory before the coyotes start killing sheep. Right. Once they start killing sheep, if someone calls wanting to buy a guard dog and they already have predation, honestly, it's hard to feel good about selling them dogs because it's probably not, it will slow it down, but it's not going to stop it. And it's still going to be really stressful. Unless they were to buy a pack of dogs from me, and that would cost them too much money. So it's a problem. They are by far the most effective means of control, but it's not perfect. And once you have predation started, it's
tough to make
pretty
the dogs
limited.
Work.
It's pretty limited.
Interesting.
Until you get such a strong pack. You know, and that's, we're talking
half dozen dogs.
At least, or more, yeah.
Did you have any trouble making the move with the dogs? Did they just, the sheep are here, we're going to stay? Or did they act confused and wondered where
it was hard to find good dogs, really hard. And I finally found a breeder that, you know, his dogs worked for me, so I just stuck with him. Actually, I found a couple different breeders.
And those dogs, when you moved them and the sheep from here down into Cooper County, the dogs stayed intact with the flock?
Absolutely.
Interesting.
Yeah. In fact, the dogs are so smart. Well, one winter I had them along Interstate 70. I mean, right along Interstate 70 all winter. Snow, ice. There was cover crop there that had great sheep feed. And I just took the sheep and the dogs and unloaded them in that pasture, and it was a woven wire fence along I-70, but it had holes under it. Not a single issue. The dogs understand boundaries, and they understand threats, so they could sense the interstate there, and they have common sense like you can't believe. In fact, they kind of had a fan club of neighbors in the area before it was done, and people would. And I told them, you can throw food over the fence, but don't go in there and feed them. Just throw it over the fence and leave. So people ended up really liking the dogs in that community. Yeah. And that was kind of cool. The dogs are the seventh wonder of the world. I mean, they are amazing. It's just hard to...
It amazes me how our guard dog, you'd think, well, the guard dog hangs out with the sheep. No, our guard dog is the leader of the flock.
Yeah.
He says, okay, guys, it's time to go to bed tonight.
Right.
I know where my food's going to be. He heads up and they all follow him.
I'm
amazed.
It can be annoying. If you want to move the sheep, you open a gate and you're going to move them to their pasture, the dog will go lay at the gate.
Yeah.
Because they don't want them to move. They want them to stay where they can make sure everything's okay. People that don't understand what the dogs are doing will get frustrated and think the dog's annoying them, but actually they're doing their job. So. You just have to think around the problem and take the dog through the gate and feed it, and then the sheep will go through. You know, it's like, that's pretty simple, isn't it? This little 3-acre pasture in front of the house, we had a bunch of ewes in there lambing, like 60 or 70, and probably every other one was having twins. And there were a couple guard dogs in there. And my daughter is really good with livestock. She was watching. And she saw one of the dogs nudging a baby lamb. It was just, you know, less than 12 hours old. And it was just bumping it with its nose and bumped it all the way across the pasture. That lamb was a set of twins that had gotten separated from his mother. And that dog bumped it over to the right mother. And
amazing.
When the dog had the lamb with that ewe, it was an immediate acceptance by that ewe. And she had another lamb at the other, you know, in the shade tree. The dog knew which lamb belonged to which ewe. And the dog knew that the lamb had been separated from the ewe. So my daughter, I'm not making up the story. My daughter, who was 12 at the time, told it to me. So, I mean, it's hard for me to believe.
Yeah.
But she's not the type that would make up a story like that. It's a pretty elaborate story for a 12-year-old to make up.
Yeah.
Mind-blowing, mm-hmm. you know.
We started out with a good dog and have had no losses to predators.
Good. Wonderful.
Yeah. And I'm fearful. You know, I don't think they're going to last past about 9 or 10 years of age just because of their size. I hope I'm wrong. But the thought of having to replace him is kind of scary. But we'll probably start on in a couple of years trying to get a second dog introduced. But yeah, they're amazing.
Yep, they are. Hmm.
Our dog, I've never seen him in action except he really doesn't like the cows around the goats.
Interesting.
And we've seen two cows without ears.
Uh-oh.
And I think that's what went on. He was protecting his goats from the cows and ripped an ear off.
Another trigger, people on bikes, they're known to not like people on bicycles. Mm. And equines. So the donkey and the guard dogs don't get along, and horses and the guard dogs don't get along. But, you know, like anything else, they have to be managed. You can't expect.
So the question was, mistakes you made, and one was you didn't start out with dogs and you kind of wish you had.
Absolutely.
Any other big mistake that you corrected or still working on?
I wish I was better at managing finance. I wish I had more training in that area.
In other words, what to do with all that money you're making?
No, how to expand without being broke. I mean, if you look at agriculture, it's very capital dependent, whatever that form of capital may be, borrowing or, you know, government support. Well, when you're in an industry that doesn't have money lent to it readily because it's odd, or doesn't have very much government support, you know, you're on your own. So how are you going to navigate that? Well, you're being an innovator, so you should attract, you know, you should attract interest and investment from some source because it's a new industry. And just how to navigate all of that, it's just the standard small business entrepreneurial challenges that people face. I guess that's the mistake, to look at the farm enterprise as an entrepreneurial business with regards to the finance of how you're going to expand and how you're going to achieve your goals. And when you're in a specialty that people don't know anything about, you know, it's difficult. It was never an area of interest. You know, in high school, I never really studied. You know, I wasn't a money man. I wasn't a money manager. I wasn't. But, you know, if you're naive in that area, you're going to get taken advantage of.
Are you, I'm trying to understand what you're saying. Are you wishing you could have been bigger operation earlier, but didn't have the finances to make that happen?
Yeah, I guess I am.
Okay.
Yeah. So we decided to build our flock instead of buying land, which that was a huge mistake given what's happened. I had no idea that I had no idea land would inflate the way it did and livestock deflate the way it did.
Yeah.
That's just the way it happened. But sure, if we could have bought land early and developed the property for grazing, you know, with permanent fence, we could actually maybe have a family vacation once every 10 years. Like now that we
going back to New Zealand, well, see your buddies back
there. Yeah, so it's been a real strain to pull off with portable fence and rented ground and more than I would have taken on if I had known.
Yeah.
It is exciting. I'm really getting into the cover crop grazing and working with the local crop farmers who want to grow cover crops. I can show them great benefit to their soil and their crop yields by letting me put sheep out there because of the soil biology benefits. I can pay them to graze it, and in a lot of cases I'll plant it for them. And that's all really cool. I really enjoy that. I really enjoy seeing, you know, it's permaculture. It's sustainable. It helps them. It helps me. It helps the soil. It helps the environment. And biggest thing, it helps the sheep. The sheep do so much better in that environment.
And you don't have to buy land to do it.
Right. So that's been sort of the awakening after the midlife crisis kind of thing. To keep us going to this point.
Flesh that out for me. All right, so when, let's say you've got a farmer to work with, this fall, what will that look like? When do you plant? What do you plant? When do you start grazing it? What?
So originally, they would fly cover crop seed and standing corn in August. Hopefully, the mix would contain turnips because that's the best winter feed. So you'd fly a mixture of turnips and radishes and cereal rye over corn in August. It would germinate, it'd pick their corn, and somewhere between October and Thanksgiving, you'd have turnips the size of baseballs and cereal rye and all the corn fodder. So when the corn's harvested, we could put sheep in there. And they do incredibly well.
You'd put the sheep in like mid-October?
It depends. Just depends on what kind of growth you get.
And rain.
Right. Mm-hmm. But more recently, last year there was a NRCS program for drought relief that paid me to plant cover crops. So I bought an inexpensive grain drill and I started planting. So,
when? What time of year?
So right after corn was harvested, okay. We just immediately after. And actually, that's a little bit of a, that's too late.
Okay, that's too third late. Week of September.
Yeah, that's
maybe.
Too late. You need to fly it on in August.
Okay.
This year is insane because of all this flooded ground. I've been drilling into almost prepared seedbed.
Huh.
So unless the river bottom floods again, the prospects for a bumper crop this year are very, very good.
And that's germinating now.
Right. I'm in the process of doing it now. I've been working late most nights doing it.
And it's, again, the mix of turnips, radishes, and
rye.
Cereal rye.
And one...
Do they take to the radishes as well as the turnips?
Yes.
Okay.
Pretty identical.
Do they eat the radish too?
Absolutely.
Or just the tops?
Absolutely. Okay. They do incredibly well on them. So this mix I'm planning on Ben Anderson's land is cereal rye, turnips, radishes, crimson clover, and milo, grain sorghum.
Hmm. The crimson clover and the milo may give you a earlier
seed
source.
Since there wasn't a corn crop, there's right. No corn fodder. So we need something dry and scratchy in their diet. Turnips on their own.
They're so succulent.
They don't have enough fiber. It's not a complete diet. So you need, and the sheep will, if they're on a really rich diet of turnips, they'll go to the fence rows and start eating branches. I mean, they really need roughage. So you got to have some rough feed in there with it. So that's the idea behind the milo. But it's getting in there so late. I suspect the plants won't get over 6 inches tall, but that'll still be helpful.
Yeah.
And it'll help the soil. The idea behind cover crops is the more diverse the plants growing in the soil, the more symbioses with biology happen that benefit the soil. So you attract more beneficial insects, you create different kind of biomes in the soil because the different species all have different root exudates. There's a whole bunch of biological magic that happens the more diverse the mix is.
Mm-hmm.
And then we're adding manure and urine on top of that. So it's just like rocket fuel.
Mm-hmm. How many acres are you going to try and plant around here in the bottoms?
I'm planting at least like 360,
okay.
And maybe more.
360
and then,
acres.
Right, and then hopefully other farmers will be planting it too, because there's a lot of bare ground out there because of the flood.
Yeah.
And I'm seeing a lot of tillage, so I don't know what's going to happen. They usually don't grow a lot of wheat, but I don't know why they're tilling if they're not going to plant something.
Yeah. Seed cost per acre, I'm guessing about $45?
No, not that much. A lot of times we'll just use bin run seed. And depending on what the farmer wants to do or who's paying for it, we'll determine the mix. But we're doing a lot of it for $10 an acre.
Oh, my. Wow.
Use a bushel of bin run wheat. Mm-hmm. Turnip is incredibly inexpensive, and radishes are inexpensive.
Mm-hmm.
So a turnip radish wheat mix you can do for under $10 an acre.
Wow.
For the seed.
That's amazing. What is the nitrogen source out there?
Just the idea behind cover crops is they scavenge nitrogen that's available. So typically you don't fertilize them. They're going to take up nitrogen that's in the soil that's volatile. A lot of it's going to get lost before next year. They'll take it up, hold it in a form that's somewhat stable so that next year it's decomposing or it's turned into manure for next year's crops.
So a lot of this land had nitrogen put on this spring, then it was planted to corn, then it flooded, and that nitrogen, some of that is still there, you figure?
Oh, sure. I mean, there's always...
Interesting.
I don't know how much.
Yeah.
But the biggest thing with brassicas, the turnips and the radishes, they are nitrogen scavengers. Mm. They will take up all available, but they give it back in a better form for next year's crop. So if you applied 150 pounds of nitrogen with ammonium with anhydrous on your corn, the corn only took 120 of that. There's 30 pounds the turnips are going to take, and they're going to save it for you. Mm-hmm. To distribute to next year's crop.
Yeah.
And we see it everywhere I've been with the sheep grazing the cover crop in the winter. The soybean yields have been up after.
Wow.
And I've not had a single complaint by any of the farmers, anything to do with the sheep. Mm-hmm. It's been all benefit.
Mm-hmm. What's your fencing plan down there? The movable electric netting or what?
Yep. And that's a major investment, both in cost and time. It's an expensive process, buying it and putting it up.
Let's say you had 360 acres in one spot. How many acres would you cover with that movable electric fencing?
I own like a mile and a half or 2 miles of it. And I don't know, the biggest field I've had fenced at one time, probably 140 acres.
Okay, you can cover a big area.
But yeah, it's a project getting all that put up.
Mm-hmm. When you attack a fencing project like that, you're pretty much on your own, or do you get some help?
Pretty much on my own, but not always. The last few years, Mike has been helping me, and he's really a good helper on the fence, but mostly by myself.
Is Micah your younger son?
No, Micah Dossler, up the road.
Oh, here. Micah, gotcha.
Yeah, your friend Micah, the goat farmer, great guy.
Yeah, no, Micah's fun.
It's mostly on my own, on a four-wheeler. That's why I have to have the four-wheeler.
It goes fast, but that's a lot of ground to cover.
It is.
Do you have to do any mowing first before you put the fence down?
Generally not.
Okay. Does it even have to be hot, or your sheep are
so
used to it?
No, it does. It does need to be. Yeah, if it's off for more than a couple of days, they figure it out.
Okay.
Yeah, you got to keep it on.
Mm-hmm.
And there's an art to that. I mean, it's a mile times 8 strands. That's a lot of wire.
Yeah.
So on a mile, I would have 2 or probably 3 energizers. So there's solar panels and batteries for each energizer. Yeah, it's a production.
Yeah. I don't know what's going on. You see the pictures in the Premier fencing magazine of goats behind the electric netting. And we bought some because we wanted to divide some of our paddocks in half. And I could not get the goats to
respect it.
They'd stick their heads through. They'd get zapped, and their reaction, instead of backing off, was to plow through it. Full speed ahead.
Get tangled up.
And this went on for 3 days, and some would be laying there, you know, getting shocked, and, you know, we were keeping a close eye on it because we knew it was happening.
Yeah.
And they'd get up, and they just, I don't know if it works on goats or not, but we've given up trying.
Yeah. Interesting. Yeah, it's a pain. It is a pain.
Right, and then they've got the horns, so they get all tangled up, and the babies are the worst. They just keep rolling in it and getting more and more.
Tangled,
you can spend a half an hour trying to untangle them.
Yeah.
So I maybe have 4 lengths of fencing you may want to purchase. I think we've quit trying.
Interesting. Well, it's like everything. Everyone does it differently. Does everything different. I mean, and you can't, there's nothing wrong with that.
Yeah.
It's just people have different aptitudes, different interests, and everyone finds their own system.
And their animals are all react differently, probably.
Right. So I don't think there's anything wrong with that. You just get a different system that works for you.
Well, it sounds like you're figuring out how to be a sheep farmer in Howard County. It's been a lot of years of working at it. What are some of the other challenges to being a Howard County sheep farmer?
I don't know. It's gotten the last 5 or 10 years working with the the neighbors and figuring out something that's mutually beneficial has been, it's been really encouraging. But those years before that, you know, it was hard. Typically in rural America, we don't
work together
as much as we should.
Yeah.
Breaking down those barriers and learning how to work mm-hmm. together, it's just really encouraging. It just takes time sometimes.
Yeah. We have a mutual friend in Pete Schwarzenberger who left the Amish community.
Sure, yeah.
And I asked him...
I've hired him some. He's a great guy.
I asked him, what do you miss about home? He says, I miss the frolics. And the frolics are where 40 men get together and in a day's flat, they throw a barn together or a house together. He said, that's what I miss.
Yeah.
People don't know how to do that.
Yeah, absolutely. That's cool. I've never seen that. I've heard of it. That would be amazing.
Yeah, I was driving through a Clark area the other day, and one of my little buddies was on a frolic. They were putting up a barn, and the sight of 40 guys on a roof working as one unit.
Yeah.
It just blew me over.
Yeah, that is amazing. Yeah, it really is.
And then it's a privilege to do anything with them because they know all the tricks.
Yeah.
You know, I never help them with a building project that I don't walk away with a half dozen new, blown out of the water ideas on how to do something with carpentry.
Yeah.
It's just, you know, they feed off each other as they learn.
Right.
Yeah, we're pretty inept at that out here in rural Howard County.
Well, I grew up, you know, working with my dad in the shop and on the farm, and mm-hmm. I was a hands-on learner all along, so I wasn't really interested in college, and that's why the opportunity to travel abroad and learn in a hands-on way was so appealing.
Yeah.
But yeah, you're exactly right.
What is your feeding schedule? Are you on forages 12 months of the year almost? It sounds like it, with your sheep, instead of out feeding hay.
I try to be. It just depends on the year.
Mm-hmm.
I manage for absolutely as much grazing as I possibly can, and if that doesn't work, I start buying feed and feed them.
Mm-hmm.
We've had a lot of really dry falls in the last 6 or 8 years, so I've had a lot of pretty crummy cover crop crops,
mm-hmm.
and I've had to buy a lot of feed in the last several years, and it's been extremely hard to find pasture to rent. So we've had some high cost years in the last 5 or 6,
mm-hmm.
But we've had 1 or 2 really good years too. So at the end of the day, it's, you know, how much
can you make it through with mediocre hay? Because that's most of what is around.
Well, I lamb late enough that if I lamb in May, they really don't need to start eating really well until 45 days before that.
Right.
Typically, we have some grazing. Typically, last year we didn't. It was such a weird year.
Yeah.
By lambing late, that's the whole point of lambing late, is to try to have them at peak production when there's peak grass growth.
Mm-hmm. And then you get by with poor quality hay through the winter.
Right.
Yeah. What about lambing late, though? Can that maybe lead to more worm problems?
Sure, it leads to other problems. Absolutely. There's always trade-offs.
Mm-hmm.
Always trade-offs.
I don't know about you, but this has been our worst year for worms.
Yeah, right, that...
heat and humidity.
Right, those years where you have those wet, warm, prolonged wet spells, you get a massive population built up. Managing worms with our limited technology, we're in a third world when it comes to parasite management and animal health. And USDA people really don't like me to say that, but my colleagues overseas, they have so much more technology and so much more animal health treatment than we have. It's incredible. There's a vaccine for barber pole worm that's not approved.
How does that work?
So,
explain how a vaccine can attack or strengthen the immune system.
I don't know a lot about it. I'm just speaking from what I hear.
Okay.
One of the problems with barber pole worm, once you really understand the life cycle, there's a sudden burst of adult worms inside the sheep. That's when they start sucking the blood. That's when they start eating the red blood cells and make the sheep anemic. And that can happen so suddenly. Sheep and goats have an immune system to fight them, but it happens so suddenly their immune hasn't kicked on yet.
Okay.
To fight them.
Ah.
So the vaccine keeps that immune turned up.
Interesting.
So when that sudden load hits, mm-hmm. they're prepared.
Interesting.
More prepared. I don't think it's 100% effective, mm-hmm. but it does help. Mm-hmm. And we need all the tools we can get because it's threatening our industry big time. Mm-hmm. And it's getting worse, particularly flocks and herds that buy and sell goats because you're bringing in resistant worms. You know, you're not only managing goats, you're managing worms. And when you buy in someone else's goats, you're buying in their worm population. And if that worm population happens to be resistant to the wormers, then you might not even have an effective treatment available.
When I met with Andy, I never dreamed we would talk together for nearly 2 hours. So we cut this off and we'll finish it next week, going into his marketing strategies and his hopes for the future of the American sheep industry. So tune in and hope you learn as much as I have from this session. If you enjoyed this session of Let's Get to Talkin', encourage friends out of the range of our low-power station to catch us online. Just Google Sam Stroop, SoundCloud, and the newest and oldest sessions will pop up. If you, like me, have a long day of being focused on my work and life, it's a great day's end to get my mind bent a bit around the life beat of the folks around me. This is Sam Stroop. Catch you next week. Let's get to talking.